You were 19 when you tried to take your own life. You had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder a couple of years before. Can you describe that day in 2000?
Yeah, I can. I had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder at 17. And 17, 18, and 19, I was inadequately fighting that disorder. I was haphazardly following a treatment plan set out by my doctor, meaning that I was not really following it well. I wasn't educating myself as to the disease. I wasn't exercising. I wasn't eating healthy foods. I wasn't taking my medications as prescribed. I take them one day and not the next, for 7 days and not for 7 days. I would, on some occasions, binge drink until blackout on the weekends while on psychotropic medications, which could have harmed me or maybe killed me. I wasn't trying to get high. I was trying to numb the brain pain in my head. And on September 24th of the year 2000, the night before my attempt, I ended up writing a note to my family, my friends, and my girlfriend at the time, and I told my family I love them. And on September 25th, I found myself at the Golden Gate Bridge after a long bus ride. And I really, you know, listen, I believe that I was an absolute burden to everyone. I believed that my family didn't want me anymore. I actually thought that they wanted me dead. My irrational thought, caused by my distorted reality, caused by bipolar, caused by my brain, led me to go over that rail that day. It wasn't an external issue. It wasn't because of a death in the family or a breakup with a girlfriend, as we so all too often in American history blame different people and different situations for one person's suicide, when it's just not that simple. It's not as simple as a breakup. It's not as simple as a dissolved marriage or a fired job. They can be the catalyst to that attempt, but there's something else going on deep inside, something mentally unstable, potentially mental illness, potentially brain pain of some kind. So many things can lead to suicide. It's not always a mental illness. It's not always mental instability, but it's often the case. And the bridge, and I thought I had to die. I thought I had to leave this earth and leave my family behind, because I thought that they didn't love me anymore. And I was wrong. I was 100% wrong.
What was it like after the first step? Did you feel regret? Did you feel relief?
It was an instant regret. The second my hands left the rail, I wish I hadn't done it. I wish I could reach back and grab that rail, and I couldn't. And I didn't step off the bridge. I threw myself over the bridge using my two hands. It was a mistake. Absolutely the worst mistake I'd ever made in my life up to that point.
You were one of only 34 people, apparently, less than 1%, who survive an attempt on their own life, jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. What happened afterward? Did a sea lion really help keep you afloat?
That's absolutely correct. Three really major things occurred to save my life. When I went over the rail, a woman driving by in a red car saw me go over that rail, and she called her best friend. Her friend happened to be a United States Coast Guard officer manning the waters of the bridge, and that was the reason the Coast Guard got to me so quickly, because of that friend of the Coast Guard. I know that story is a fact because the two of them, the officer and the woman in the red car, happened to be great friends with my high school band teacher, Mr. Blount, who was a volunteer Coast Guard officer. In the water, as I flailed to stay afloat, not doing a very good job, kept going under, swallowing salt water, I thought I was going to drown. Before the Coast Guard arrived, something very large, very slimy, began circling beneath me. I remember thinking at the time, I didn't die off that bridge, and a shark is going to eat me. And I thought that was ridiculous. And I was trying to hit the thing away from it, but it wouldn't go away. It just kept circling faster. No longer was I wading in the water to stay afloat. I was floating atop it on my back, being bumped up by this thing. I always joke in my speeches that I thought to myself, what a very nice shark. You know, and people tend to laugh at that, but what happened, how I found out what really went on that day, was after some time, I was on a suicide prevention campaign on national television, on primetime live on ABC. ABC actually has this email, as do I. And we got an email in from a man named Morgan. I won't say his last name. And Morgan wrote into the show. And he said, I said on the show, I thought there was a shark breathing at one point on the show. And a man wrote into the show when the show went online. And a man wrote in, and he said, Kevin, I am so very glad you're alive. I was standing less than 2 feet away from you when you jumped. He said, until this day, seeing this show, no one had told me whether you lived or died. He mentioned that it had haunted him until now. He said, by the way, Kevin, you said you thought there was a shark beneath you. There was no shark. But there was a sea lion. I have pictures. And he showed my father those pictures, and my father fell out of his chair. When he got the picture online, he went on his full screen. He had a PC back then. And so I know for a fact that a sea lion absolutely kept me afloat, and you can see it in these pictures. I will never release these pictures. They're morbid and quite triggering of memory for me. And, you know, although it was a beautiful thing that animal came to my aid, it was still the most horrific moment of my entire life. I was there, and so is the sea lion. And I've named him Herbert, by the way.
Kevin, what about the injuries that you sustained?
Broke my back. I shattered three vertebrae, crushed part of it into powder. Here's the thing. We could talk about the hit and the fall and the jump as long as we want, but the reality is that's not what's helpful for the people out there right now who are listening, because they need to find out how they find recovery. I think that part of the thing the media is missing in covering suicidal ideations or attempts is that really important story of recovery. Not saying you are, but I'm saying too many questions about the jump for too long could have someone, one of your listeners, hearing this and thinking about the negativity of that aspect. But I'd really like to discuss how I stay here every day with chronic suicidal thoughts, how I live every day fighting my mental illness, and how that fight, that resilience, is never-ending for me, because I live with all of these symptoms: paranoia, depression, hallucinations, auditory and visual, panic attacks, anxiety issues, attachment disorder. I have a lot of issues. It's an intriguing story, and I know many people have covered it that way, but I think it's time to change, to shift the paradigm in the conversation about this story and every attempt story. See an attempter, we're not so uber-focused on the drastic, traumatic situation, but we get focused on real recovery aspects and how people can change their lives so they can stay here and how their families can help them do the same.
Those are the next questions.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, though. 16 years later, you're an author. You wrote a book called Crack Not Broken. You are a globally sought-after speaker. You have won numerous awards as a mental health and suicide prevention advocate. You travel. You have admiration. You have respect. Would you feel the same way about your life if you had gotten out of the hospital and gone back to being the person that you were before you jumped?
Yes, because even with all that stuff you mentioned, I've never changed. I'm still the kid that had a traumatic infancy, who was sick as a dog as an infant, who was taken in by the Hines family, who was made a Hines. Patrick and Deborah Hines are my mom and dad. I'm still the kid that went and sought out and found his birth family years later. I'm still the kid that won that wrestling championship in high school and grew up. I'm still the same me. You know, if none of this ever happened, if none of this talking about it on such a global scale ever occurred, if I wasn't making a movie called Suicide: The Ripple Effect, a documentary about the hopeful aspect of stories that help people heal, if I wasn't doing any of that, I'd still have great value, dedication and drive in my life to do whatever may come my way. And I'd still be loving to my family and caring to everyone I hold in my circle, and I would still be fighting bipolar disorder if none of this ever happened. It would just be a different road, and who knows where it would lead. But we're here now, and I guess we're focused on that.
You've talked about continuing to struggle with many of the symptoms of bipolar disorder, as you had asked to. Talk about what keeps you here every day.
Yeah, you bet. Well, first of all, I wrote an article on HuffPost about staying alive and well with this daily struggle. So you can find it there. But I utilize a 10-step system that I created with a doctor friend of mine. Of simple, really common sense tools to stabilize your brain pain, if you will, if you're going through something like this. There's tools that can be utilized if you have an overstressed job at work, or if you're stressed out at school and you've got AP classes up the wazoo and you just want to slow down and calm down. These are things that can help you heal if you have a serious mental illness. They can help you find and stay in recovery and cope with these struggles, these symptoms, because they're not going to go away. It's a chronic thing, mental illness. I rather call it a brain disease because it derives from the brain, and it's chronic. Illnesses go away. It's there forever. So today, I do things like constantly educate myself about bipolar disorder and depression, constantly reading the new materials on those issues, reading books as simple as Bipolar for Dummies, the first, second, and third edition, by Candida Fink and Joe Cranack. And I got a little piece in the third edition that I wrote as well. Just because I wrote to them and said, hey, I'd love to be a part of your process because it helped me for so many years. And they said, let's do it. Or BP Hope magazine, found at bphope.org. It is the place to go for your information on bipolar disorder, to help you stabilize, read stories from people who've been there and come back from the brink, read stories of people that are going through it right now and trying to find ways to survive, read articles about the newest findings, treatments, and research in bipolar disorder. Next to that, I've joined the International Bipolar Foundation, headed by Muffy Walker and Elisa Bernard, and this is a group that is dedicated to traveling the world, helping people with bipolar disorder and their families learn the tools to stay here. And so all of these things are a part of my daily routine, including eating healthy foods most days, very healthy foods that feed and help give good nutrition to your brain, not just your body. If you're feeding your body good foods that help the brain, you're going to be a more mentally healthy person. And the reality is, what I learned was that, and this is something I talk about in my speeches, the brain is the most powerful organ in our body, and it happens to be the largest, and it is the one that is most neglected. So if you think about everything you do in your life and relate it to how you can use everything you do in your life on a daily basis to help your brain, you'll live a better life. And so education, exercise, eating healthy are the first three. Getting a good sleep pattern. Now, if you're an insomniac, that's a hard thing to deal with. I was an insomniac. I had to work tirelessly. This is a funny thing to say when you're trying to go to sleep. I had to work tirelessly to work on a better sleeping pattern. And there were nights where I forced myself to stay in bed as I stared at the ceiling, wanting to get out of bed and do work and do things and get going. But if I did that, if I got out of bed, I realized I would be less at rest than I was laying down. And eventually, with the help of music therapy at night, 20 minutes before I go to bed, I could get that good sleep that I needed. And I'd probably get about 7 to 8 hours, 5 out of 7 nights a week. And that's a gem. That's a great thing to have, right? Because when you sleep, you're regenerating brain cells that make you feel better when you're awake. All these things are crucial to your physical and mental well-being. Coping mechanisms, things like, for me, sketching. I'm a sketch artist. I've been a sketch artist since I was a little boy. I have sketchbooks going back, I think, when I was maybe 5 or 7 years of age. And they're consistent. And they help me get the pain out of my head, onto paper, get moving. So things like that. Refraining from all drugs and alcohol, except for my prescription medication that helps me heal. Taking that medication with 100% accuracy without fail every day around the exact same time of the day. Eating foods and meals at the same time of the day, roughly around the same time of the day. Snacks can be a little more varied. So all of these things and so much more, things like utilizing Blue Wave Lightbox technology. This is something that Cal State Channel Islands University is using for all of their counseled students. When they have a severe mental illness like major depression or bipolar disorder or even seasonal affective disorder, they are prescribed, much like my doctor prescribed me, Blue Wave Lightbox therapy, which actually helps increase mood. It's like enhancing a low-grade natural antidepressant in your body because it's like the power of the sun going back into your eyes and the back of the brain and helping you feel better when you take it accurately.
Do you still have that inner voice that speaks harshly to you? And does it ever get under your skin? And what do you do?
Every day. Every day. But it doesn't get under my skin anymore because now I know where it comes from. Now I know that that inner voice comes from a distorted reality brought on by my brain's chemistry, and I will never let that inner voice defeat me again. On that note, I do have chronic suicidal thoughts, but they'll never kill me because I know how much I deserve to live. I realize how precious life really is, and I realize it's a gift. And I'm going to cherish this life until I die of natural causes. No matter the pain my brain is causing me, I will stay alive until I die, hopefully lying in my sleep when I'm 102 or 112, holding my wife's hand. It's something that I deal with every day, and that's okay. I look at it differently now. I don't look at the voices in my head like a burden. I look at the voices in my head like a call to action. I just have to work that much harder to make them go away.